Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Donelda Pulex stepped off the airplane into the sun, holding her 5-year-old daughter's hand. She began to cry. 14-year-old Ermelindo Juarez hid his face as his father held him. Elfildo Daniel Vasquez walked carefully behind his 8-year-old son. 11 families that had been detained and separated at the U.S. border returned home to Guatemala. They appeared quiet, unsure, and tired. They flew to Guatemala on a plane rented by the U.S. government. Guatemalan First Lady Patricia Muroquin greeted them when the plane landed. U.S. immigration officials turned the family's paperwork over to the Guatemalan officials. Then the families walked together into a wide gray building on the country's military base to be processed back into their home country. Rented planes full of deportees from the United States often arrive in the Central American country, but this flight was among the first to return families separated at the border under President Donald Trump's zero-tolerance policy. More than 2,300 children were separated from their families before an executive order ended the separations on June 20th. Although some Central American migrants say they were fleeing their home country to protect their family from violence, the parents who spoke with the Associated Press said they made the difficult, dangerous crossing to the United States for a better life. They were hoping to get a good job or provide a better education for their children. They did not know they would be separated from their children under the policy, which criminally charged anyone caught crossing the border illegally. Trump administration officials had said the policy was necessary to put an end to a growing number of illegal border crossings. Trump ended the separations following national and international anger. The parents who spoke with the AP said they were upset that their difficult journeys had ended in failure. But they also said they were happy to no longer be separated from their children. Donelda Pulex said she was separated from her daughter for 2 months as she waited in an El Paso, Texas detention center. It was a great torment, she said, as tears flowed down her face. I did not know if I would ever see my daughter again. I thought she was taken from me forever. Her young daughter, Mary Lynn, said she talked to her mother by phone from a foster care home in Michigan. My mother, she was so sad. She would cry for me, and I would tell her, Mammy, everything is okay. I am okay. I will see you soon, Mary Lynn said. She said the people who cared for her were kind and treated her well, but she missed her mother. I am happy to be back with her, she said. Inside the Guatemalan military base, the families were taken into a hot, crowded room. They were given food and water and told to wait for a medical examination. Then came more paperwork. Finally, each family was given a bus ticket to return home. Some lived in the mountains more than 7 hours away. About 75 people were aboard the flight. The AP asked at least 24 adults if any of their children were still in the United States because they were deported without them. All said no. There have been other media reports of parents being deported without their children. Elsa Ortiz Enriquez, who is Guatemalan, said she was deported last month without her 8-year-old, Anthony David Tovar Ortiz. The boy remained in a center for migrant children in Houston, Texas. Inside the immigration building, Pulex helped Mary Lynn drink her water. She then pulled the little girl's hand up to her heart and kissed it. And Ermelindo Juarez told his father, Davin Juarez, that he felt very tired. The two made the trip to the U.S. border in early May. They had spent 2 weeks getting there with very little food. We were starving, Juarez said. Ermelindo said he did not know where he was going when he was separated from his father. He also said he and his father were not able to communicate with each other easily during their time apart. The boy was sent to a center in Tucson, Arizona. He said he was treated well there. He studied and played soccer. I felt comfortable there, he said. There were children there from Brazil, from India, and Guatemala, he said. He did not know how many had been separated from their parents or how many had entered the United States alone. More than 10,000 children who crossed the border alone are in U.S. government care. Davin Juarez and some other parents said they had paid thousands of dollars to smugglers. They said they would not likely try the journey again anytime soon. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. When temperatures rise, many people swim to beat the heat. But swimming does a lot more than give relief from hot weather. It is a great workout for the whole body. Health experts at the University of California, Berkeley, write on their website, Berkeley Wellness, that swimming is an ideal way to stay in shape. Swimming is a high cardio but low impact exercise. Cardiovascular exercise is often simply called cardio. Cardio involves the heart, lungs, and circulatory system. The Berkeley experts say swimming is great for your cardiovascular system. It increases your heart rate and exercises your lungs without putting stress on the rest of your body. Some high cardio exercises, such as running, can improve your health, but can also be hard on your body. Swimming, on the other hand, is so easy on the body that people often use it to heal from injuries. A former competitive swimmer, Paul Wass, now coaches a team of swimmers. He says that swimming is easier on the body than other sports because it is low impact. For this reason, it is a common exercise for people who are in rehabilitation, or rehab for short.
Well, swimming is a lifelong sport. It's a non-impact sport, and it's horizontal rather than vertical, and so it's great for a lot of rehab from running injuries and things like that.
A mother with two daughters on Coach Wass's swim team agrees. Paloma says that for her girls, swimming has been easier on the body than some other sports.
So far, I think it's been good for their bodies. There's a lot of exercise, as you know, but it spares their knees, their joints, etc. But it's rare to get injured in swimming.
The coach adds that swimming is a great exercise for kids who grow a lot in a short amount of time. Again, here is Coach Wass.
One of the things swimming is really good for is kids who go through really intense growth spurts, and their bones might be hurting and they're aching all the time, and then they get in the pool and, you know, they can float and stretch out a little bit, and it relieves that as well.
Swimming is also good for people with disabilities or with chronic conditions such as arthritis and back pain. People who are overweight can find relief swimming. Their weightlessness in the water can help them to avoid injury as they exercise. As we said earlier, swimming is an all-body workout. It works small muscle groups that often get ignored in other workouts. As you move in the water, many small muscle groups are working to help keep you balanced and upright. However, swimming is not without any risk of injury. Many types of swimming use repetitive arm movements. Over time, the repeated movement can cause shoulder and neck injuries. This is especially true if the stroke is not done correctly. To reduce the chances of getting hurt, swimmers can use different kinds of movements in the water. For example, they can mix standard swimming strokes with running in water, treading water, and other water exercises. The researchers at University of California, Berkeley warn that another downside to swimming and other water workouts is that they are not weight-bearing exercises, so they do not help to strengthen bones. To make sure your bones are getting the exercise they need, the researchers suggest combining swimming with a weight-bearing exercise. Common weight-bearing exercises are dancing, walking, running, or jumping rope. Paloma, the mother we heard from earlier, adds that she was concerned about this issue. Her older daughter, Priya, has mostly been a swimmer, so playing what she calls a terrestrial sport has helped give her daughter a good balance.
This year, our older daughter has done more what I call terrestrial sports, which are contact with the earth. And I think it's been actually good for her to have the mix, because she only has been a swimmer, primarily. Okay. And so you can be in swimmer shape, but your muscles are not being challenged. So it helps really balance out. If you're a basketball player all year, that's not great for your body. But if you swim half the week and do other sports, I think it's good balance.
But for many swimmers, these downsides seem manageable when compared to the health benefits. Coach Wass agrees.
You know, swimming can have some injuries from high repetition, but in general, it's one of the safest and healthiest sports out there.
Besides the great workout you can get from swimming, Paloma brings up another important way it can help. It can help to keep you alive.
My husband and I believe that swimming is a life skill. That's a life and death situation. You can swim your way out of it. And as such, we really wanted them to be strong swimmers.
Her daughter Priya knows that swimming is good for her body. But perhaps the reason she likes to swim is more basic. It's just fun.
The water, of course, it keeps you cool while you're swimming. It's also, you get a whole different way to use your muscles. And overall, it's just fun to do because you get to stay in the water a lot.
And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States entered the Second World War in December of 1941. Europe had already been at war since 1939, but the United States did not enter World War II until Japanese forces attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The attack was a surprise, but American military and political leaders had believed that the United States, sooner or later, would be pulled into the fighting, and they began to prepare for war. President Franklin Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson during World War I. He remembered how American troops were not ready for that war. Now that he was president, Roosevelt wanted to be sure that the United States would be ready when it had to fight. Throughout 1941, Roosevelt urged American industries to produce more weapons and other military supplies. He established new government agencies to work with industry to increase arms production. Some business leaders resisted Roosevelt's efforts. They felt there was no need to produce more arms while the United States was still at peace. But many others cooperated. And by the time Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the American economy was producing millions of guns and other weapons. Still, this was not enough to fight a war. After the Japanese attack, Roosevelt increased his demands on American industry. He called for 60,000 warplanes, 45,000 tanks, and 20,000 anti-aircraft guns. And he wanted all these within 1 year. A month after the Pearl Harbor raid, Roosevelt organized a special committee to direct military production. He created another group to help companies find men and women for defense work. And he established a new office where the nation's best scientists and engineers could work together to design new weapons. These new government organizations faced several problems. Sometimes factories produced too much of one product and not enough of another. Sometimes tools broke, and some business owners refused to accept government orders. But the weapons were produced, and American troops soon had the guns and supplies they needed. The federal government had to quickly expand its own workforce to meet war needs. Federal spending increased from $6 billion in 1940 to $89 billion in 1944. That was 15 times as much spending in just 5 years. Roosevelt had to take strong steps to get the money for all this spending. He put limits on wages. He increased income taxes to as much as 94% on portions of incomes over $200,000. And he asked the American people to lend money to the federal government. The people answered by purchasing almost $100 billion in war bonds. The great increase in public spending raised the threat of high inflation. Roosevelt created a special office with the power to control prices. Many Americans agreed with the idea of price controls, but every business wanted somebody else's prices controlled, not their own. Federal officials had to work hard to keep prices and supplies under control. They restricted how much meat, fuel, and other goods people could buy. The price control program generally worked. Its success kept the American economy strong to support the troops fighting in Europe and Asia. One reason these strong economic steps worked was because most of the American people fully supported the war effort.
She's the part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little friend can do more than a myth can do. Rosie, the riveter, Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production lead, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie, the riveter.
You can look at photographs of people from those times and see in their faces how strongly they felt. In one picture from the state of North Carolina, a group of men are standing in front of old rubber tires. They are planning to give the tires to the Army to be fixed and used for military vehicles. Another photo shows a woman visiting a hospital. She is singing to a soldier to lift his spirits. Still another photo shows a man who owns a small food store. He is placing signs on meat and cans of food to tell people how much they are allowed to buy. You can also get an idea about the feelings of the times by the names of some of the popular songs during World War II. In addition to Rosie the Riveter, there were songs like Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. One of the most hopeful songs was this one, recorded by Britain's Vera Lynn.
When the lights go on again, oh.
Not all Americans supported the war. A small number refused to fight because of religious or moral beliefs. They were known as conscientious objectors. And some Americans supported Adolf Hitler and other fascists. But almost everyone else wanted to win the war quickly and return to a normal life. Many Japanese Americans served with honor in the United States Armed Forces. But many Americans were suspicious of anyone whose family had come from Japan. They refused to trust even Japanese American families who had lived in the United States for more than a century. Many banks refused to lend money to Japanese Americans. Many stores would not sell to them. The federal government relocated thousands of Japanese Americans in California and other states into internment camps. They were released only after the war ended. It was many years before the government officially apologized for mistreating Japanese Americans. But World War II did lead to progress for another group that was often the target of discrimination, Black Americans. Black leaders spoke out. They said it was unfair to fight a war for freedom in Europe while Black Americans did not have all the same freedoms as white citizens.
Negroes want the same things that white citizens possess. All of their rights, and no force under the sun can stem and block and stop this civil rights revolution which is now underway.
In 1941, a leader in the Black community, A. Philip Randolph, threatened to lead a giant march on Washington for civil rights for Blacks. President Roosevelt reacted by issuing an order that made it a crime to deny Blacks a chance for jobs in defense industries. He also ordered the armed forces to change some of their rules that discriminated against Black service members. Blacks made progress in the military and defense industries. But most other industries still refused to give them an equal chance. Major progress on civil rights would not come until the 1950s and 60s. Life was busy during the war years. There were many changes in the economy, business, music, race relations, and other areas. But in many ways, life continued as it always does. Americans did what they could during the hard years of World War II to keep life on the home front as normal as possible. But almost everyone understood that the first job was to support the troops overseas and win the war. This strength of purpose at home gave American soldiers the support they needed, and it also helped President Roosevelt as he negotiated with other world leaders. Diplomacy and foreign relations became much more complex during the war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.